Grace to you and peace, sisters and brothers, and the one who is, the one who was, and the one who is to come. Good morning, saints.
Good morning.
Good morning, sinners.
Good morning.
We're all here. And all that we are is here, and I am delighted to be here to see all of you. And we're going to spend a couple days together, and this is going to be fun. And what Ken insisted that I kind of divvy up my talks into these little components, but we're just going to be organic while we're together. So if we fit into these categories, that's great. If we don't, we will just make it up as we go along. I went to a seminary that some of you may have heard of, although indirectly. It's a seminary called Colgate Rochester Bexley Hall Crozer. Now, the seminary that you probably know of the most, but whose name you know the least, is the Crozer one. But somebody else went to that seminary. Anybody know?
Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King Jr. Exactly. He got his PhD at Boston School of Theology, but his MDiv he got at this school. It was in Chester, Pennsylvania, and then it moved to Rochester, New York. And I went to Rochester, where his legacy was still very, very strong. So over the years, I've picked up a lot of King stories, and I thought I'd begin today with a Martin Luther King story that you may not have heard. Dr. King taught only one course in his entire life. In 1960-61, the president of his alma mater, which was Morehouse College in Atlanta. Yeah. Dennis and I were talking on the way here. Dennis picked me up in the airport. I said, you know, two of the most famous pastors in U.S. history from the same state. And it was kind of a test. And Dennis did pretty well. He got one of them, which was King. The other one was John Wesley, who both pastored in Georgia. I didn't say a successful pastor. You know the Wesley story. It was a fiasco. But King agreed. His friend Benjamin May said, would you come back and teach a course in social philosophy? Well, actually, we put you on the faculty. So he actually had faculty status for this one kind of year, 1961. And May said, I want to open up the student body to your thought, to your teaching, and so we're going to open up this course for everybody. And so it was available to the entire student body, and 8 students signed up. Let me just repeat. I mean, if King were teaching a course here today at IWS, how many? So we had 6 men, 2 women, who actually signed up to take this course with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So literally, he's the only people in the world that can say, I was a
student
of Dr. King. He's the only people in the world that can legitimately say, Dr. King was my professor. So they're an elite group. And they know they're an elite group. And so they meet periodically for reunions. They just get together and keep the memory green. They congratulate each other for the only ones that had good sense to take this course. Tell stories, but at the same time they get together and wring their hands. Because not one of them saved the syllabus. They also wring their hands because Dr. King required 2 papers, which he marked up extensively, passed back. Not one of them saved those papers. He required a final exam, which he graded and passed back. In those blue books, remember those? Not one of them saved the blue book. Now, one of them took a picture of them and Martin Luther King Jr. Not one of them has any evidence they ever took to court. other than the fact that Dr. King gave them a grade and they're in the official register of Morehouse College as having taken that course with Dr. King. By the way, just a King signature on a receipt starts at, I think, $11,000. You have to monetize it. One of the worst things you can say about anybody is they stood in the presence of greatness and they missed it. Greatness passed by and they missed it. I had a chance once, a friend had a ticket to go see Louis Armstrong. And you know, I had something better to do that night than to take that ticket. Go see Louis Armstrong, and not long after Louis Armstrong died. To stand in the presence of greatness and to miss it. To miss your moment. I begin with this because this is one of the greatest challenges I think the church is facing today. This is one of the greatest times in the history of Christianity to do ministry. One of the most exciting, challenging, exhilarating, frustrating. These are the best times and these are the worst. And by and large, the question is the church missing its moment? Are we standing in the presence of this great moment and missing the moment that God has given us? Now, this is not the moment I would have picked. My PhD is in church history, so I can live anywhere, and I don't live now. In my imagination, in my research, in my thinking, I'm a Victorian, Edwardian person. This is the time I'd have picked. My research interests are in this period, about 1860 to 1910. My favorite show of all time is, can you guess? Downton Abbey. Can I get a witness? Anybody?
Yeah.
Thank you. Season 4 is on its way. I am so excited. Lord. My wife and I keep a Victorian household. We have this little tiny house on Orcas Island up in the Pacific Northwest. It's a 2,000 square foot house, and we've stuffed it full of Victorian antiques. So you step into my home, you're walking into a time warp. We even keep Victorian rituals, one of the most important of which is two desserts. You always serve at least two desserts. You kind of one of my advances, because Christians don't retreat. We only advance. And you have to get a cane. Part of your being there is everybody gets to pick their cane, and their cane goes with them. I mean, so this is... this is the time I'd love. This is the time if I could pick any time to be alive in the ministry, 1860, 1910. But you get to pick your furniture, you don't get to pick your moment. And in the sovereignty and providence of God, God has chosen you and me to serve this present age. Wesley Brothers, who had some things really smart, and one of them which was that, as John Wesley put it, you're sooner remember a song than a sermon. So he and his brother had this tag team match, and his brother Charles took his sermons and put them to song. And Wesley proved prophetic, because you've all sung a Charles Wesley song. You've never preached a John Wesley sermon. Or even heard one. But Charles Wesley, a little insidious, because even in some, I don't know what tribes we have here, but even in some of your hymn books that are non-Methodist, non-Wesleyan, you look at the index, the first song in the index is a Wesley hymn. And it's this song, "A Charge to Keep I Have, a God to Glorify." The second verse, "To serve this present age," our calling to fulfill. And this is the essence of our calling. God called, chose, and going to sound like a little Calvinist here, but in the sovereignty and providence of God, God has chosen you to serve
present age.
This present age. Not the age we wish we had. Not the age we were prepared to do ministry for. But to serve the age we got. So you can just think how it's going to set one day when you stand before your maker, and I stand before my maker, and I say, and you say, when we have to give an account of our charge. There you go. That's just, I love the sound of that. Thank you. For all you Lutherans. You know, Lord, I didn't really like that moment you gave me. I really prefer the 1970s. So I pastored a church really faithfully for the 1970s. Lord, I really didn't like that 21st century world with all that digital electronic stuff, you know. So I faithfully served the church for the 1950s. See how that's going to work for you. To serve this present age. So let me say something about this present age, just a little bit. Again, this is hard for me because I was born B.C. A lot of you here were born A.C. But I was born...
Take it home.
Baby. Take it home. We ought to have an altar call after. B.C. is before cell phones. A real watershed here. 1973. Y'all know who Alexander Graham Bell was. How many of you know who Martin Cooper was? Our kids will. Because Martin Cooper invented the cell phone. Now, it didn't look like this. Came in a body bag. Had to hold it with both hands. I rent movies just so my kids could see people walking down the street. Rent Network, if you want to see what I'm talking about. But this is a whole, this cell phone technology and all that goes with it. Because, see, this is a Bible. And this is as much a Bible as a book Bible. In fact, I got 26 Bibles in here. So if you ask me to swear on a stack of Bibles, I can do it. But this is, I mean, try, can you have done ministry in the last 500 years and said, I'm sorry, I don't do books? Okay. Can you do ministry in the next 30 years and say, I'm sorry, I don't do social media? This is the moment that God has given us, and I am having to learn this thing. I'm having to, and I sit at the feet of my children. Who are the experts, the Alexanders of the world, who are teaching me so much about what it means to live and move. My, by the way, 22nd century kids. Let's get this right. I didn't say 21st century. Most important person in my life, I thought my mother, her name was Marie Aul, lived in Dayton, Ohio. She was a philanthropist, a gardener, created the largest learning center of the National Audubon Society. She was born in 1897, and she died in 2005.
That's fantastic.
That's the norm. A female born between 1990 and 2000, actuarial studies reveal, already have a 60% chance of living well into the 22nd century. So if you've got any kid born after 1990, grandchild, child, you look at them as 22nd century kids, because their lifespan is going to take them well. Your church is norming and forming faith in 22nd century kids. How you doing? This is the present age that God has given us. Now, I call the book world the Gutenberg world. You can call it the modern world, the Enlightenment world, book culture, print culture. I just call it a Gutenberg world. The world we're living in today, I first started calling it postmodern, and that got all confusing. So then I called it a Google world. Now I've refined it a little bit, and I call it a TGIF world. TGIF stands for... Now, thank God it's Friday.
Twitter.
By the way, in South Africa, TGIF stands for, I love this, the gift is free. Isn't that great? We have a TGIF gospel. The gift is free. Twitter, Google, Instagram, Facebook.
Yes.
That's the world in which we live. Twitter, Google, Instagram, Facebook. All of which are here. Now, I have a computer. I call it my brain bag, because part of my brain now is outside my body. But I'm like Larry here. I have to have a computer that looks like the technology I grew up with, which is a typewriter. So I have a computer that looks like this. But I'm a dinosaur. This is as much a computer as this. But to give you an idea how fast things are, and for our kids, they're increasingly moving to this, away from this. How fast things are changing in this TGIF world. In May of 2013, we celebrated the third anniversary of an iPad. iPads have only been here for 3 years. Nobody owned an iPad in April of 2010. That's how fast they were. So part of this TGIF world is not carpe diem, because the only way you can hit a moving target is what? Get ahead of it. It's carpe mignana. Seize tomorrow. And that's one of the challenges with this whole best practices mentality, because best practices wed you to what isn't going to work in the future. Because we've always got to be... Now, the excitement is that where's the primary time zone by which Jesus appears to us? We have this idea that Jesus is in the past pushing us into the future. But in a biblical sense, even if you read any of Moltmann or anybody else, Jesus is not in the past pushing us into the future, but Jesus is where? In the future, ahead of us, pulling us towards Him. So this is the exciting thing about carpe mignon, exciting thing about a TGIF world. This constant openness to the Spirit that is in the future beckoning us to follow and to fall in behind what Jesus is already doing. So I begin with this really openness to new things that the Spirit might be up to. Now, at the same time, I don't want to leave the past behind. And this ancient future thing is very important to me. I started writing about it in the mid-90s as well. But hear me, you live out of the past, you don't live in the past. The past is something that you live out of, not in. In fact, the best symbol of this kind of carpe mignana is in Hebrews 6, where we have this marvelous... The earliest image of the church was the boat. But the boat always came with an anchor. And the anchor was right here in Hebrews 6. But the anchor, read carefully, it says, That hope we hold, it is now the hope, the rope of hope, is this anchor. That hope we hold, it is like an anchor cast before us. The tradition, the symbol of the tradition, the anchor. The anchor is not something that keeps you in place, not moving. The anchor is something that you cast into the future. It's, by the way, in sailing, this is called kedging, where you're in a storm, you don't know where you're going, it's very treacherous, so you take the anchor, you pull it out as far into the storm as you possibly can, you let it go, and then you winch your way into the future, guided and guarded by the past. The tradition is something that pulls us behind, but takes us forward. So this is what we're going to be talking about. Worship for this kind of a world. Worship that does not leave the past behind, but takes that tradition and casts it into the future. This tradition, I think another image for it that we should have picked up before the world did is the cloud. Now, the world steals our best lines because we don't know we have it. And they've done that with everything, including mission. You know, we're only doing mission statements because the business world did mission statements. Because we abandoned the word mission in the 70s. No fear. A company made billions off of that when that's really our line. Have no fear, be not afraid. We can't translate that into contemporary language. So the world does it. But this cloud, the great cloud of witnesses, we are guided by the cloud. So we move into the future and we trust the cloud. And the cloud is the storage of our memory. And we do not leave that cloud by day, pillar of fire by night, guides us. Guards us into the future. So, if you're looking for if you're not open to some radical new possibilities about how to be led by that cloud into this future, this is not a seminar for you. This is a seminar on how do we trust that cloud as we move into this incredible future, where 30 years from now, the biggest issue for me will be with James sitting here, is this really James? And some of you are going to spend the bulk of your ministry beyond 30 years from now. Because James might have rather gone golfing today. So he sent his what?
Avatar.
And I will know it's James. You see, we'll have a whole different interface. It won't be the eyes. We won't be able to trust your eyes. Your eyes will be deceitful. You won't be able to, is this real or is it not? Or where are we? A little bit into that. Has that been photoshopped or not? James, has he been holographed here? Or not? Then I won't know he's real until I what? Okay, so I call it the resistance of the real. So in the future, the major interface to the culture, to reality, will be a touch. And so we'll have touch in and touch out rituals, which is kind of hard for the church since it's abandoned the touch. Freaked out about touch. In the very time when we're moving into a, well, Nesbitt said this a long time ago, the greater the high tech, the higher the tech, the higher the touch. So, all right, let me stop there. Comments, questions? Anybody? But the nature of the world in which we're called to serve.
Are you really here right now?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You heard of the new Google Glass? Here it is.
Yeah.
Eyeglasses.
Yeah.
Do you think that'll be helpful to
you
for ministry?
Yeah, I do. But here's the problem that we have. Every age is equidistant from eternity, like that, I want to put it. So you have certain, every age you get certain blessings, but you also get certain curses.
Yeah.
So part of the challenge is to know what the blessings are, but to know what the curses are. So I see these Google Glasses as tremendous blessings, but also tremendous curses. Yeah. As is this technology. But that print culture, by the way, was a great blessing, but an awful curse. Print book is the most antisocial medium ever invented. Let me repeat that. Print. Books. Most anti, what did I say?
Social.
See, you don't have a concept of individualism until print. That's why when Luther said, here, I stand, he invented the power of the perpendicular, the individual. And the modern world has taken individualism and gone to hell with it. We've gone beyond individualism to narcissism. And actually, we've gone beyond narcissism. There's another word beyond narcissism. It's called solipsism. You don't know what solipsism is? I'll give you an image for it. Charlie Sheen. At least the narcissist knows other people exist. Okay. The solipsism is in a universe all by themselves. I think the world totally revolves around them. If there is another world, then they are at the heart of it. Narcissists just in love with themselves, but they know other people are there.
Can you spell that word for me?
Yeah, S-O-L-I-P-S-I-S-M, solipsism. Solipsism. That's a step beyond narcissism. And that's what print culture has given us. See, in print culture, who's your everybody else? I draw in the corner by yourself. You read individually, privately, singly, silently. It's as antisocial as you can get. It's as individualistic as you can get. Before print, or the 15th century, do you get to pick who you want to marry? Do you get to pick where you want to live? Do you get to pick what you want to do for a living? You were totally defined by your community. Everything was communal. Print culture created a whole new culture. And this was a challenge of worship because they became very individualistic, privatistic. You might even say narcissistic. Church is a place to meet my needs. Oh, really? It's all about meeting my needs.
So we're just going to take it off.
Yeah.
So Lisa, you suggest then that the social media of the age in which we're living is a kind of push against the print culture?
Yes. Social media is by definition social. It connects you. Print culture separated you. Social media connects you. Now, the challenge is it connects you. This whole media promises something, though, that it can't deliver. It promises relationship, connection. But it can't deliver on real connection. So what happens is, that's why I say this is a great time for the church, by the way. Because the more Facebook, and what Facebook, I'm going to just use it as a metaphor here, but the more Facebook promises connection, relationship, but it can't deliver. So people, when they're out off of Facebook, they have this huge ravenous appetite for the real thing. And the real thing is face-to-face. FaceTime. In your face. So the more Facebook, the more the culture is hungry for face-to-face, in-your-face, FaceTime, community. And that's what the church can deliver. The problem is, the church, but it's got to be authentic face-to-face. It's got to be real face-to-face. The problem is, most of our churches are not authentic face-to-face. They're pretend face-to-face. Or they're, you know, we bought into the... And this is the problem with seeker sensitive. We have so many problems with seeker sensitive worship, but where do I begin? As if, yeah, we're the seekers and God's the hider. Have you read your Bible? I mean, this is our story, is that we're hunting for God and God's hiding from that? Read Genesis. The hiders are the hounders. The seeker. We have a seeker God. The seeker model, which is all about anonymity. You can come to church and nobody has to know who you are. You just sit there and be anonymous, and we're going to put on the greatest show for you that you've ever seen. So you don't have to. We make no demands of you. We're going to knock your socks off. That's not a Facebook culture church. Where the hunger is for authentic, real, face-to-face, in your face, God's face, relationship. Anybody else before we go? Is it hard to hear about your need to take social media seriously? Initially for me. I mean, I resisted Twitter and Facebook for a while. And was called out by an Alexander. Alright. If we are called to serve this president, then first thing we have to do is take this president age seriously. One of the biggest things I think God's up to right now is 500 years ago, there was a Protestant Reformation. One of the things we learned in the Protestant Reformation is something that we should have known for 1,500 years, but it was always there, but we just took a long time to discover it. Some truths in the Bible have long fuses. Right? And it took 1,500 years for this to blow up. The priesthood of all believers. Your baptism is your ordination as a minister. So your baptismal certificate is your ordination certificate. Every one of you, by virtue of your baptism, is a minister of the gospel. Now, we learned that 500 years ago. We're still coming to terms with it. Implications of it. Some tribes are a little more resistant than others about extending what it means, extending that ministry to everyone, but it's something that we learned 500 years ago. What I think is blowing up now is something that it took 2,000 years for us to understand, but it's now, it's been a long, long fuse. And that is, you are by virtue of your baptism, you're not just ordained as a minister, but your baptismal certificate is also your commissioning as a missionary. In other words, that every one of us is both minister and missionary. So I want to know what your ministry to the body, but I also want to know what your mission in the world. So you have a ministry to the body, but you have a mission in the world. And this is the whole missional church thing. Now, unfortunately, a lot of the missional church, that's become another program, which is really death knell if it doesn't get changed quickly. But as part of this, you already heard the phrase, already missio dei, misunderstanding that we're all about God's mission in the world. It's not our mission, it's God's mission. David Bosch in South Africa, I just was there last week, is the one who first wrote about this and helped to discover this, the transforming mission, a classic, maybe the most important missiological text of the 20th century. And that it's all part of God's mission. That God, the very being of God, is a missional God. and we participate in that mission. Now, the first thing, so every one of us, and this is a challenge for us, for our churches. I mean, let me just give you a metaphor. Ministers do potlucks. Missionaries do block parties. How many block parties is your church doing? Versus how many potlucks you doing? Or Presbyterians, you call it covered dish. Or Episcopalians, it's terrine suppers. Whatever you call it. Sorry, Michael. Whatever you call it. We're much better at the potlucks than we are the block parties. But God's calling us out now and saying, it's time for you to get missional. Jesus gave us a mission statement. Now, the reason why we came up with our own mission statements is, by and large, we didn't like the one he gave us. But he did give us a mission statement. Go into all the world. To do what? Make disciples. Now, notice it didn't say make leaders. Okay. We've had a leadership fetish for the last 30 years. Don't get me going on that. Make followers of Jesus Christ. By the way, Twitter only has two categories. Who are you following? Who's following you? This culture is, that celebrity culture, they want to follow. They're hungry to follow. They just don't know who to follow. And they're following all the wrong people. We're trying to make leaders. No, you. This is a function of the church, is to make disciples. Disciples of Jesus of all what? Now, I would not use. I think it's very dangerous to translate that as nations. You don't have. When people think of nations, they think of a nation state. You don't have a nation state until 1648. A nation state and denominations are both product of modernity. 1643, you get denominations, Westminster Assembly of Divines. 1648, Treaty of Westphalia, you get a nation state. So you 17th century is when you get nation states. People think of nations, no, culture groups.
Yeah.
People groups, what we're talking about this morning, a multicultural mission. But the mission is not the multicultural. Our mission is not, let's celebrate difference. Okay? Our mission is we make disciples who are different. See, it's disciples of Jesus. It's the multicultural mission to make disciples. Difference is not the end in itself. Jesus is the end. Now, I divide this into three things. Go into all the world. Go into all the world. First of all, that's the missional component. Make disciples of Jesus Christ. That's the relational component. Of all cultures is the incarnational component. You hear that? So it's got these three, and I call this the operating system of Christianity. The OS. Whatever age you're in, the OS stays the same. Now the reason why we had to write mission statements is we didn't want to do MRI. Missional, relational, incarnational. See, that word go, we changed it to come. How do we get more people to come to church? So we were not doing missional church, we were doing attractional church. Now, there is an attractional component. Let's get this clear. But the attractional component is not come to church, it's come to Christ. So the attraction is not us, the attraction is Christ. The attraction is not look how well we do worship. And this whole thing, the second part, go into all the world, make disciples of Jesus Christ. We put in other things there than Jesus. Make leaders, make justice. We had a lot of inserts. And this is one of the greatest challenges we got right here. If I ask you to close, I'm not going to ask you to do this, but if I were to ask you to close your eyes and give me your definition of truth. Okay? I say, what is truth?
Truth?
Truth. T-R-U-T-H. If the first thing that doesn't pop in your head is Jesus, you're in a bad default. You try and give me a propositional definition of truth. See, that's Islam. And ironically, we got too many Christians who are more Muslim than they are Christian in their understanding of truth. Because Christianity has a weird understanding of truth. I mean, it's as weird as they get. I mean, you can't get any weirder. The problem is we're not weird enough. Moses had students, sent him out in the world, said, follow my commandments. Confucius had students, sent him out in the world, follow my sayings. Muhammad had students, sent him out in the world, follow my five noble pillars, my teachings. Aristotle, follow my teachings. Plato, follow my teachings. Jesus, follow. Yeah. This is huge. Truth is a relationship. We have a relational understanding of truth. Truth is a person who calls us into a relationship. That's what it means to make disciples of Jesus Christ. We are following a person. We aren't following a set of teachings. You get this? This is huge. So, we weren't doing missional, we were doing tractional. We weren't doing relational, we were doing propositional. The final thing is, we were doing incarnational of all cultures. We're doing colonial. And that's why I'm very nervous around the word transform. Okay? I'm a missionary to China. I'm going to go to China. Here's me in China. Hi, Chinese. I'm here to transform your culture. Really? No, I'm here to incarnate the gospel what? In your culture. See, the gospel doesn't spread as a potted plant. And by the way, it's been a Western potted plant. The gospel spreads as a seed. And comes up differently in whatever the culture is. So, this is my seventh trip to Africa. Second time I went to Africa, I'll never forget it. I was so excited. I was preaching at an African church. Everybody was there in African garb, you know, with all the incredible colors. And it was a beautiful day, so we decided to go out under a camel thorn tree, which is kind of the stereotypic African tree. We're going to go out there and worship under the tree. So I'm going, how much more African can you get? So then it came time for the first song, and we sang Shout to the Lord. I came halfway around the world to sing Darling Jack. Am I in Australia? No. I'm in Africa. Where are the drums? Where's the dance? See, the gospel's incarnated and African culture is going to come up. Africa. So, but we have been so oriented towards franchise church, which is another form of colonialism, that we don't really know what it means to do incarnational church. Let me give you one more metaphor for it before we have to take a break. Nobody has really studied the emotional life of Jesus. There's so much about Jesus we absolutely don't know because we haven't been asking the questions of our day. Questions of our mind. We're not living in a world where we know that your EQ is more important than your IQ. Your success in the world How would you define success? Depends more on your EQ than your IQ. Your EQ is? I believe Jesus was the most creative person I've ever lived. I believe Jesus, if you talk about like this, had the highest IQ of anybody ever lived, and he had the highest EQ. But nobody's ever studied his emotional quotient. And we've got Elton Trueblood, this book a long time ago in the 50s called The Laughter of Jesus, but it's so dated now, and it's still fun to read, but we have looked a little bit at his laugh life, just a little bit. We haven't looked at what makes him angry. What makes him sad? What makes him happy? He was human in every way we are. So what made him cry? Jesus cried twice that we know of. He cried many more times, I'm sure. But two times the Bible says Jesus cried. One time he cried over what? A person. All right? And who was that person, Lazarus? Who was he? To Jesus. His best friend. Where did Jesus love to hang out?
Sinners.
But he loved to hang out when he wasn't hanging out with sinners. He loved to skate. With his friend Lazarus and his
sisters.
Little place called Bethany. He loved to hang out with them. Jesus' best friend was not one of the 12. Pastors, are you hearing this?
Yeah.
You better not have as your best friend one of your inner circles. Because you know what? Your inner circle will do what? Betray you. By the way, the whole key to the story of the Dives and Lazarus, the only person that Jesus named in the story, the only character Jesus named in the story was the name of his best friend. And do you ever wonder why? It's the key to understanding the story. The key to understanding. We've totally misinterpreted that Lazarus and Dives story. But the key to understanding it properly is to come to terms with the fact that he named the poor man his best friend. The other time Jesus cried was over a place. The place was? Jesus cried over a person and a place. So, let me just put it baldly. Do you love your place enough to cry over it? Let me put it more sharply. Your church has a zip code. Do you love your zip code enough to cry over it? Do your people love their zip code enough to cry over it? Do they even know their zip code enough to cry over it? See, by and large, we're not doing zip code ministry. We aren't doing zip code church. We're doing franchise church. We go to some place else where somebody else has got a zip code and doing really well in their zip code, like Saddleback and Willow Creek. I say that right? West Virginia. So, and we see how Bill Hybels doing his zip code, Rick Warren's doing his zip code. So then we go try and take their zip code back into our zip code. So we're trying to do their zip code and our zip code. It's called franchise church. No. Time to start doing zip code church. How many of your merchants in your zip code have been visited by your church who have let your merchants know we're here for you? We want you to succeed. We're all in this zip code together. Let's all support one another. You got a subway in your zip code? Most likely you do. How many times have you had a block party at that subway? Or use that subway for a block party? The more global the world getting, the more local it's becoming. The glory of the local church is not how global it is, but how local it is. And we are not doing local church. You particularize in order to universalize. You don't get to the global without doing the local. And the key mark of the future is not show me your how big your numbers are, but how authentic, how resonant is your local story. The hottest speaker on college campuses today, both Christian and non-Christian, is somebody by the name of Shane Claiborne. Everybody wants Shane Claiborne to speak. You know what I'm talking about. Shane Claiborne has no numbers. Took over part of a block in the city of Philadelphia, started a little community there, and said, we're going to claim our zip code. Not even the whole zip code, part of the zip code. They got 39 people. That's the numbers. I didn't say 39,000. I had a pastor came up to me not too long ago, and you know his name, something. He said, Glenn, what would you do if I told you that the Lord told me that within 5 years I was to increase my church by 10,000 people? I said, I tell you, it wasn't the Lord who told you that. He never spoke to me again. His wife came over, she heard it, pulled him away, and I never saw him again. Thirty-nine people was all that Shane Claiborne has. The numbers of what he's got is the resonance of an authentic story in that zip code. That's the measure of success in the future, the resonance of an authentic story. And the more authentic and zip code your story, the more global will be its appeal. All right. The operating system, we're in a bad default, sisters and brothers. Most of our churches are not in MRI, they're in APC. Before I begin anything, before I talk about the epic interface, because interfaces come and go, and interfaces are in some ways neither good nor bad, they're just an interface. We got to get the operating system right. The operating system of the Church of Jesus Christ is going all the world, missional, make disciples of Jesus Christ, relational of all cultures, incarnational. And an epic interface will work with any, I mean, you can use it. An interface will work with any operating system. So you can, the key is not just to have success. The key is to have the right operating system. So I just want to make sure as we begin, thank you, Jesus. Jehovah Java. That's the title I wanted for my Starbucks book. They gave me the gospel book to Starbucks, so I wanted Jehovah Java. throughout it, I wanted Jabaluja. Instead of Babaluja. We got to get out of the attractional, propositional, colonial mode. We got to get into a missional, relational, incarnational mode. All right, time for break.